Tonight will be from Esther 4, 10 through 17. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go in to the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him.
We're going to be looking this evening at the book of Esther. And of course, our reading that we had kind of directs our attention to some things as it relates to Esther. This is one of only two books that have the name, the title of it being after a woman. Of course, the other one is Ruth. And we've already looked at Ruth earlier in our series of studies as we consider the various books of the Bible. What we find as a background to the book of Esther is that the events recorded in the book of Esther took place during the years of the Israelite captivity between 483 and 473 BC. This would place the account for the first Jewish remnant, after the first Jewish remnant returned to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel's leadership, and before the second group arrived under the direction of Ezra. Esther was a Jew who became the queen of Persia. She was thus in a perfect position to help thwart the evil plotting of Haman, who was attempting to have all Jews in the Persian Empire murdered. And that's kind of the backdrop of what's transpiring here. You go and you look at the time period. Of course, Zerubbabel's returned with that first remnant. We looked at the things over there in the book of Ezra. It's during that period of time, after that first return, before Ezra returned, that you have a point in which we see Esther being then put in this position as queen. And it's an interesting story, of course, of how that came about, what was involved in this. Let's look additionally then and think about the memory verse, or the verse to kind of help us focus on the theme of the book. Esther 4:14, "For if you remain completely silent this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Now, that expression, the idea, this was Mordecai, who was and related to Esther. He's the one that's giving some instruction. He's older, wiser. He's already given her some direction in life to help her understand what would be the right way to handle certain matters. So here's Mordecai. And he sends back this message, and he points out that at this point in time, there's a very critical circumstance ongoing as it relates to the Jewish people. They're in grave danger. And so he says, you're placed there, and who knows that this may be the reason God has put you in this position for saving the Jews. There's some interesting things in this passage, and we'll kind of highlight some things here before we press on. There was no question in Mordecai's mind that deliverance would come. Because he said, if you don't do it, it's going to come from some other source. God will protect his people. But he does point out her responsibility in her position that she is now in to go and do what she can to save the Jews. In fact, that may be the very reason God has placed her there. And so she had an obligation. And remember, there's a great deal of danger associated with her going before the king, even as the queen. And we'll talk about that additionally. So what's the theme of the book? God's protection. God's going to protect. And that's seen even in these verses here. As you look at the book of Esther, it's identified in a varying ways as we consider the skeletal outline of the book of Esther. First of all, God's protection when his people are threatened by enemies, and that's the first four chapters. And this just kind of gives us the sense of the story as it unfolds in the book of Esther. Esther, the Jewess, becomes queen after King Ahasuerus selects her to replace the former queen, Vashti. And that's all dealt with in the first couple of chapters. The story about the reasons that took place are noted there. You can go through and see that. I think for our purposes in this study this evening, the main thing is to see that here was the opportunity where the king was going to seek out another queen, and Esther was part of that process. And what we find taking place then is that she becomes the queen. Mordecai, the cousin of Esther, saves the king from a murder plot, and that's in the latter part of the second chapter. And that plays an instrumental role as well in the events that are described. He finds out about those individuals who are plotting to kill the king, Ahasuerus. He then goes and warns Ahasuerus, the people there around him. As a result, the plot is thwarted, he is protected, and his name is put in a book that comes up later in the story. An accounting of these events are placed there. A record is noted. We see that Haman becomes angry with Mordecai and plots to kill all the Jews. So we go into the situation, which has to do with the arrangements as they're unfolding, Esther becoming queen. But Haman is a very important authority, a dignitary in the ruling of the Persian government. He's been placed there by Ahasuerus, the king. He has a good deal of then responsibility that's placed upon him. And he's very arrogant, obviously from the description of it, a presumptuous individual, seeking the limelight. All those kinds of things are part of the character and the nature of Haman. Well, when Mordecai doesn't show respect to him by bowing down to him, he becomes furious about that. And he becomes angry. And not just then when he finds out about Mordecai and looking to Mordecai specifically, he sees it as something even in a broader context, since he discovers that he is a Jew, he wants to kill all the Jews in the kingdom and among the nation. Those that have returned the remnant that returned, all those within Persia, they've been scattered after the Babylonian captivity and all these places. So he's plotting then to have all the Jews in the kingdom murdered. Mordecai appeals to Esther to intervene on the Jews' behalf to King Ahasuerus. And that's what we read there in the fourth chapter. She's in that position, so he's encouraging her. You go to the king. You tell him about this plot. Tell him what's going on here. He's unaware of all the consequences and ramifications of this situation. In the second half, then, of the book, God's protection demonstrated by providing victory over his people's enemies. And that's chapters 5 through 10. As you look at the latter part of this, then, there's going to be this which unfolds. And described of it, Haman plots to hang Mordecai on a gallows, and King Ahasuerus honors Mordecai by following Haman's suggestions. And that's an interesting account in and of itself, that you see these things taking place. We'll discuss this a little bit additionally in the later, when we look at some of the lessons that we can glean from it. Excuse me. So pressing on. And incidentally, these outlines are on the back table if anybody wishes to pick those up. Been putting outlines for each of these lessons. Esther reveals Haman's evil plans to the king, and then Haman is hanged on the gallows prepared for Mordecai in chapter 7. This again is dealt with in the context of what unfolds. And Esther then, through a series of events, then reveals that Haman is the individual who has plotted against not only Mordecai, but against the Jews as a whole. Then the king authorizes the Jews to protect themselves, and then God gives them the victory in the 8th and 9th chapters. And the Feast of Purim is established as a Jewish observance, and Mordecai is promoted to the king's service. And that's in the chapters 9 and 10. Now, I'm going to be losing my voice here. I can already tell that this is not working out too well, so bear with me a little bit. So we're going to press on a little more hurriedly in this account and let you then kind of at least get the overview of what's going on. This part that I've just described and talked to you about It's all there on that back table, and you can look at it, go through a study. In fact, I encourage everyone, when we're doing these things, not just to take this information. It's a helpful way to approach the books, to get the outlines, to kind of get it in our minds how these things unfold and how they're arranged. And in the case of Esther, it's a very compelling story. There's a lot of things associated with it. In fact, if you look at Purim and do a little more examination of that, this is another one of the feasts and festivals that comes along after that. Of course, we see that God had already established a number of these previously, having to do with things pertaining to their observances like Passover, Pentecost, for example, that we read about in the New Testament. Purim is now one that comes up as a consequence of these events having to do with Esther. And they then celebrate the victory, and that's what this is all about. Okay, sermon lessons and applications. So you're going to get a short lesson this evening. And they say miracles don't still happen, right? So what I'm going to do is, you can look at this. I'm going to highlight it for your consideration. There are three points that we'll make, and like I said, they'll be run through more hurriedly this evening, and I apologize for that. First of all, comforted by God's providential care. Providence, and I think it is important to kind of take just a moment and think about the idea of providence. I mentioned miracles in a humorous manner just a moment ago. Miracles is God operating in a supernatural way, outside of the natural laws and arrangement. Providence is God operating through nature, through the laws that He set up. And God is operating. He's operated from the very outset. He continues to operate today. When we talk to the Pentecostals and they say we don't believe that God is on His throne, that He's working, that He's still in charge, they say that because we say there aren't miracles today. Miracles don't take place. There isn't any supernatural things occurring. And they say, therefore, you're denying God's workings. And that's not the case. God operates providentially. That is, God is still operating through His natural means. He's still on His throne. Things still happen according to His will. It's just not obvious by something being taken out and in a manner that is supernatural, outside of the natural laws occurring. And God has always operated providentially. Only through certain instances in Scripture, certain times, do we see Him operating supernaturally. But He's always operated providentially. If you go to look at these verses of Scripture, we talk about the providential care of God. The very first one having to do that here, Esther being on the throne, and what Mordecai said and stated about this idea that you're being placed there because, you know, that may be the very reason for your being there. That's the case of the situation where God, in His providential working, has arranged for you to be the queen. And so that's part of what transpires. You think about the occasion when Mordecai then discovered the plot that took place, and Mordecai then revealing that. Here's another instance of potentially God providentially operating to put Mordecai in good light as it related to the king. And so you see these cases that are described. In other instances, Numbers 14:9, 1 John 4:4, all of these have to do with God's providential care. He cares for us. He loves us. He sees to us. He's still operating. And that's the idea of the providential nature and care and working of God. Providence does not bar us from acting. So if I'm talking about God providentially working and He's in charge, what is there for me to do? Well, the point is, I am to be involved in doing what God expects of me and requires of me. That's true with all of us. Just because God had put Esther on the throne, Esther still had the ability to choose whether or not to act. Now remember, Mordecai had already stated that deliverance may not, you know, deliverance is going to come from God in some form or fashion. But you could be the one that He's using to accomplish this. But if you don't do it, God's still going to deliver us. Well, here was the appeal to Esther to go before the king. And in that context of going before King Ahasuerus, that would be the way in which this information is presented to him. So he knows what's going on. He's not aware of Haman and the things Haman is involved in. So consequently, he then gives her this charge. So what does she do? She acts. It was treacherous. It was dangerous because, as it's stated there, if she goes into the king uninvited, then the king, you go in there and present yourself. If you haven't been invited, you'll be put to death unless the king extends his scepter And so doing says that this is something he accepts and approves of. So she took her life in her hands to go do this. And so she asked for the prayers, for the feasting, for the people to fast during the time when she was preparing to do this. We see other instances in Scripture about the providential nature of God, the things acting in Matthew 6:11, providential nature. We're to then pray for our daily bread. But now when we say pray for our daily bread, does that preclude us from having to go and work and to provide this? God still provides it for us, but he expects us to go and do it. Prayer in accompaniment with our behavior and conduct is what's stated. God providentially cares for us, but part of that is he's made provisions for us to go and accomplish the things he expects of us. And so we need to act. We need to be about the task. So you think about 2 Thessalonians 3:10, man won't work, don't let him eat. And then this last one. And that is the evil plotters are ensnared by own conduct. One of the things that sort of stands out, some of these lessons, and as we look at the various things, sometimes they overlap. There's some information sometimes we say in a little different way. Some stand out in this respect, and so you kind of cover some of the same information and material. This one stands sort of separate from these other things that we've covered or looked at because of Haman. Haman, with his plotting and planning, with his devious ways in which he's trying to act and behave, what we see with Haman is that he sets this whole arrangement up, and in the context of setting these things up, he ensnares himself. He traps himself. Proverbs 5:22, 11:5, these are descriptive of these same kinds of things. You go to the Proverbs. Proverbs talks about ensnaring ourselves in our own traps. That's kind of a paraphrase of the thought or the idea. And what you find over in 1 Corinthians 3:18-20 of warnings about certain elements associated with this idea, the plotting plan. When we try to do things and we're trying to be devious and the ability to get something accomplished, then first of all, we're doing wrong in and of itself. God does not approve of that kind of conduct and behavior. It's condemnable in itself. We may think we're getting away with something, but eventually we're going to be called to account. In the case of Haman, and what we see here, which is a very instructive incident in the Scriptures, is that Haman goes and he then, first of all, sets up this plot. He goes before the king about the Jews as a whole, in which he says, and so doing, he would also get Mordecai, but he was going to kill all the people that are the Jews and get Mordecai and at the same time. He goes and he sets this up. He tells the king that there's these people out here that are opposed to him, that are troublemakers, that are going to give him all these difficulties. He says, you know, we need to get rid of the king. And by the way, I'll take care of that for you. And your treasury will also be increased. No doubt he had planned in his slaughter of the Jews, he would also then take their monies and things that he'd coordinate and he'd put it in the treasury, some of those things, probably enrich himself as well. I don't doubt that that would be part of the outcome. But as a result of all those things, the king would be profited. And these people that were troublemakers would be done away with. And the king says, sounds like a good idea to me. So, moving right along, Haman seems to be able to accomplish this thing. He still looks at Mordecai. He's jealous, angry, envious of all these things going on. Mordecai won't humble himself before him. So he decides that's not even adequate and sufficient. He decides he's going to build a gallows. And the gallows is going to be where Mordecai would be hanged. So this goes back to this incident where the king one night, not able to sleep, and this is that providential element associated with it. Certainly God's hand can be seen in these things. He's having read to him from that book that records the various things that have happened and taken place. And in the context of that time and occasion where he's being read to in his sleepless state, they come across this thing with Mordecai and how Mordecai had revealed the plot, the murder plot against him. And he says, has anything been done for this Mordecai? And they said, no, nothing's been done. So he's pondering this. And so he'd been through the night looking at this thing, and here comes along Haman. Haman enters into the presence of the king. And the king asks a question, and the question was along the lines, what should we do to honor the one that the king wishes to show pleasure to? And Haman immediately, in his arrogant presumptuousness, thinks that's about him. He says, oh, I've got this brilliant idea. You take and have him put on the horse, the white horse, and royal robe, and as he goes down, led down by a person that was in a position of royalty or a position of authority, and have them call out that this is the one to whom the king honors. King thought that was wonderful. And so he says, well, so do that to Mordecai, and you be the one that takes the horse and you take him down through the city and you cry these things out. And he was, of course, devastated by this. Then you follow along with the events that unfolded. Esther reveals to the king about the plot that had been occurring, and after he seemed to be, Haman had been put in this position of, but the king being invited into Esther for these feasts, but then it's revealed, and then Haman is the one that was taken out and hung upon the gallows. And the king in his fury and his anger had him hung. Now, the point I want to make about that is, we may think we're pretty clever, we're pretty on top of things, and if we try to be devious and we try to come up with certain plotting and planning and we're trying to get our way on things, the end result, we're always going to fall in our own plots and our own devious schemes will come back to haunt us. Now, it may not happen in this life. It may not occur. We may get away with a whole lot of things and think that we've really accomplished a great deal, that we've gotten our way through these various means that we do in order to maybe get people involved and scheming with us, that we maybe deceive them to think of certain things. All this type of situation can occur and has occurred even in the body of Christ, that people do these types of things. The point is that it's always wrong. It doesn't matter whether we get away with it, at least in this life. In fact, the devastation and the harm that can be done as a result of these things sometimes incalculable, and that cannot be then something that creates all kinds of problems and difficulties within the church. But the bottom line on all that is, one day we're going to stand before the Lord and we're going to give account of what we've done in the flesh. And that should be the thing that causes us to always be doing what's right and to handle ourselves correctly and to deal with matters in an appropriate way. Haman was hung on his own gallows and will be lost eternally by such behavior and conduct. So if you look at these things and continue to study these various books of the Bible and the story of Esther, again, there's a lot of things there, things associated with Esther that are very revealing and very helpful. And I trust and pray and hope that these things are profitable for us to consider, because the bottom line is, we want to serve the Lord faithfully, don't we? And we know that the only way we can serve the Lord is to do things rightly in this life and to treat others correctly and to be about the task of helping each other make heaven our eternal abode. We're about to sing a song of encouragement. If you're subject to the Lord's invitation in any way, please come forward as together we stand and sing.